House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, May 10th, and let the record reflect, it is 3:21 p.m. Today we have present Representative Carpenter, Representative Gray, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Linda Jensen with House Records and Talia Ames with the Juno LAO. Thank you for your work. On today's agenda, the committee will have its first hearing on Senate Bill 53, Competency and Voluntary Civil Commitments by Senator Klayman in its first hearing. And then the committee will also receive a first hearing on House Bill 4, Elections, Repeal Ranked Choice Voting in its first hearing. So we will now, I would like to invite Senator Klayman and his staff to the table to hear Senate Bill 53. If you could place your names on the record and begin your presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the House Judiciary Committee. I'm Matt Klayman, representing Senate District H in West Anchorage. Senate Bill 53 is a clean, straightforward solution to closing a gap between our criminal justice system and our behavioral health system when a person is incompetent to stand trial and should be involuntarily committed to the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Last February, a man with an extensive criminal and psychiatric history stabbed Angela Harris in the back as she waited to return books at the Lusac Library. Her assailant, Corey Akavak, had prior criminal convictions and prior criminal cases in which he had been found incompetent to stand trial. 2 months earlier, Mr. Akavak had attacked two other women and then was released to the community after they dismissed his case because he was incompetent to stand trial. Mr. Akavak should not have been released when they dismissed his criminal case. Instead, they should have brought a petition for involuntary commitment that should have been filed based on his history of violence and his psychiatric condition that made him a danger to our community. First, Senate Bill 53 closes the gap between the civil and criminal systems. With passage of this legislation, the state prosecutor must file a petition for involuntary commitment before the court dismisses the criminal case because the defendant is incompetent to stand trial and the defendant is charged with a felony offense against the person or felony arson. Second, Senate Bill 53 protects Angela and other victims who must have better assurances that we are protecting the community so that Angela and others can move forward. For individuals who have been found incompetent to stand trial for these dangerous offenses, it establishes an option for the courts to enter an involuntary hold of up to 2 years, and it gives victims of crime the right to attend the involuntary commitment proceedings of those who attacked them and the right to know the status of those involuntary commitment proceedings. Third, Senate Bill 53 protects the due process rights of individuals in the state's care. It allows the person to petition for discharge from involuntary commitment if they show evidence they are no longer a danger to themselves or others. And the bill confirms that the burden always rests on the state to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the respondent should remain under involuntary commitment. The detailed committee process thoroughly reviewed, amended, and improved this legislation. The version before you today includes important updates to related areas of criminal procedure in Title 12 and civil commitment in Title 47. In closing, I would note that we must not let the horrible events of February 13, 2022 that changed Angela Harris's life stop us in our tracks. It has not stopped Angela, and I do not believe it ever will. We must take Angela's example to heart. We must all move forward from that February day, learn valuable lessons from her experience, and take positive steps to improve public safety. Passage of Senate Bill 53 is the first step. And with that, my staff, Emma Potter, is here to present a sectional analysis of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. Please continue with the sectional.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Emma Potter. I am staff to Senator Klayman. Section 1 amends AS 1247-070, subsection A, to reduce the number of qualified psychiatrists or psychologists from 2 to 1 for evaluation under the affirmative defense of insanity. This matches the number of evaluators required in other areas of statute and removes the requirement that the psychologist is certified by the American Board of Forensic Psychology. This recognizes that there are no psychologists in Alaska with those credentials. Section 2 amends AS 1247-100 subsection B by adding the requirement that the court make findings of fact and conclusions of law that justify ordering a competency examination. Section 3 amends AS 1247-100 by adding a new subsection I that sets out the factors for the court to consider in deciding whether to order an outpatient competency examination as a condition of bail. Section 3 adds a new subsection J that allows a qualified psychiatrist or psychologist to evaluate the defendant for involuntary commitment at the same time that they conduct an examination for competency. The new subsection K in Section 3 states that the court may rely on a defense attorney's ex parte representation in making findings of fact and conclusions of law for competency examination. Section 4 amends AS 1247-110 by adding a new subsection F that sets out the factors for the court to consider. That sets out the factors for the court to consider in deciding whether to order an outpatient competency evaluation and treatment as a condition of bail. Section 4 adds a new subsection G, which states that upon the court finding that the defendant charged with a felony offense against a person or felony arson remains incompetent at the expiration of the period for competency restoration, the prosecutor shall, 1, file a petition seeking involuntary commitment under the new AS 4730-706 before dismissal of charges, 2, notify the Civil Division of the Department of Law within 24 hours after filing the petition, and 3, provide the court's findings to the Civil Division of the Department of Law within 24 hours after the court's ruling. Section 5 amends AS 4730-705 by adding a new subsection E, which states that the department shall promptly deliver a person who is detained awaiting transport to a crisis residential center or evaluation facility for evaluation. The person may not be detained for more than 10 days while awaiting transportation unless a court extends the detention under subsection F of this section. Subsection F states that the department or facility detaining a person may file a request to extend the detention based on the person meeting the standards for commitment and a continued need for hold. The request must include a verified or certified statement of a mental health professional and be served on related parties, including the respondent. This section sets factors that the court must consider when deciding on a request to extend the detention pending transportation. Subsection G states that the court shall schedule hearings if requested by the respondent, which shall be held no later than 72 hours after the expiration of the 10-day detention period. Subsection H states that at any time during the detention period, the mental health professional at the detaining facility shall release the respondent if the person does not meet the standards for commitment. The facility shall notify related parties if the respondent is released.
Vice Chair Allard.
Yes, thank you. Are you reading the sectional analysis? Or are you reading something different?
This is a sectional analysis. I'm sorry, through the chair. For the record, this is Emma Potter. I'm reading a script I have of the sectional analysis.
I do apologize for interrupting you, but under subsection H, I will admit I am hard of hearing. I wear hearing aids, but I could have swore you said shall, and it actually is written may under facility of subsection H. And I just want to make sure that it's on record that it says may and not shall. There is definitely, and I know Senator Klayman knows this, but there is definitely a difference in may and shall in the legal terms.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Allard.
Thank you. And I didn't want to call you out. I just want clarification.
And so if we're looking, you're speaking about Section 5, subsection H.
Yes. Can you help me out there then?
So my reading of that section says that the respondent shall be released.
Okay. So I was, and I apologize, I was looking at professional at detaining facility may release. You didn't say may. Did you say shall or may? I apologize. You said shall?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then it says may on my paperwork. Am I wrong?
For version T.A that I'm looking at, on line 7 of page 5, I'm reading that it says the respondent shall be released.
Okay. Then just the subsection is?
Vice Chair Allard, she's referring to the pages of the bill.
Okay. I'm looking at your a sectional analysis, and I'm okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, and there must be an error in the sectional analysis. So it does say shall in the bill. Yep, yep, on the same page. Thank you. Okay, so moving past subsection H and into section 6. Section 6 amends AS 4730706 by creating a new section that's titled Commitment After Finding of Incompetence. Subsection A states that if a person who has been charged with a felony offense against a person or felony arson has been found incompetent to proceed with criminal charges and before the charges are dismissed, an attorney with the Department of Law shall petition the court to have the person delivered to the nearest evaluation facility for an evaluation. Subsection B states that upon receiving the petition under A of this section, the court shall issue an ex parte order stating that there is probable cause to believe the respondent is mentally ill, and that condition causes the respondent to present a likelihood of serious harm to self or others. Appoint an attorney to the respondent and may direct that a peace officer take the respondent into custody and deliver the respondent to the nearest appropriate facility for evaluation. The court shall set a date, time, and place for a 30-day commitment hearing within 72 hours. Subsection C states that a person taking into custody for evaluation under this section may not be placed in a jail or other correctional facility except for protective custody purposes and only while awaiting transportation to an evaluation facility. Subsection D states that an individual charged with a felony offense against a person or felony arson who is found to be incompetent to stand trial is rebuttably presumed to be mentally ill and present a likelihood of serious harm to self or others. This presumption creates the basis upon which the court can issue the ex parte order to hold the respondent. This section states that in its evaluating whether a defendant is likely to cause serious harm, the court may consider the conduct with which the defendant was charged. Section 6 amends AS 4730710 in a conforming change by adding reference to the new section, AS 4730706 subsection A, to AS 4730710. Section 8 amends AS 4730725 by adding new subsections G and H, which create notification provisions for the victim of the dismissed criminal case. Subsection G states that the victim shall be notified of the time and place of the civil commitment hearing, the length of time for which the respondent is committed and findings of fact made by the court, and when the respondent is discharged from commitment. Additionally, subsection G states that a victim in a dismissed criminal case has the right to attend the civil commitment hearing of the respondent. Subsection H states that this section does not give a victim in a dismissed criminal case the right to access confidential records. Section 9 amends AS 4730-727 by creating a new section addressing the release of records to the Criminal Division of the Department of Law by the Civil Division during the involuntary commitment of an individual who is found incompetent to stand trial. Subsection B states that records disclosed to the Criminal Division are confidential and requires that the documents be sealed to protect their confidential nature. Subsection C states that the facility housing a respondent found incompetent to proceed and involuntarily committed shall provide notice to the prosecutor in the criminal case of hearings scheduled by the court in the civil commitment case. Section 10 amends AS 4730735 subsection B so that victims in dismissed criminal cases where the respondent was charged with a felony offense against a person or felony arson have the right to attend civil commitment proceedings of the respondent. Section 11 amends AS 4730771 by adding a new section creating an additional involuntary commitment of up to 2 years. 2-year commitment petitions are filed at the expiration of 180-day commitments for individuals who meet the following criteria. 1, the respondent is mentally ill and as a result is likely to cause harm to self or others. 2, the respondent has a history of felony offense against a person under AS 1141 or felony arson. 3, the respondent has been found incompetent to stand trial under AS 1247-100 and 1247-110 for a felony offense against a person or arson. 4, commitment of the respondent for greater than 180 days but not greater than 2 years is necessary to protect the public. And 5, the period of commitment is necessary to protect the public. This section states that findings made at the 30-day, 90-day, and 180-day commitment hearings shall be admitted as evidence in subsequent hearings. It also states that successive commitments are permissible on the same ground and under the same procedures as the original commitment. Section 11 instructs the department to submit an annual report to the Attorney General, Public Defender, Public Advocate, Alaska Court System, and the Attorney of Record of the respondent, detailing how many respondents are committed under this section and how much time remains on each order of commitment. Section 11 amends AS 4730-780, subsection A, in a conforming change to include reference to the new subsection C of AS 4730-780. Section 13 amends AS 4730-780 by adding new subsections. Subsection C states the professional person in charge may not discharge respondents who meet the standard of dangerousness set forth in the legislation from 180-day or up to 2-year involuntary commitment orders unless the court enters an order officially terminating the involuntary commitment and the court gives the prosecuting authority 10 days notice of the discharge. Subsections D and E state the respondent who is committed under an up to 2-year commitment may order under a 2-year commitment order may petition the court for early discharge at any time with a 180-day limit on frequency during the commitment if they present some evidence demonstrating that the respondent is no longer likely to cause serious harm to self or others. The court is required to grant early discharge unless the state proves by clear and convincing evidence that there is a factual and medical basis to believe that the respondent remains likely to cause serious harm to self or others. Section 14 amends AS 4730-805 Section A to include 2-year commitments. And finally, Section 15 amends AS 4730-845 Section A in a conforming change to include confidential records released to the Criminal Division of the Department of Law under Section 8 of this legislation. And I'm sorry that was lengthy, but I appreciate you bearing with me.
Thank you so much for that sectional. It's very much needed. Senator Klayman.
It's up to the chair's preference. We're happy to answer questions. If you'd like to hear Ms. Harris's invited testimony first, we're happy to let her go first. It's totally up to the chair.
I think it's appropriate to hear Ms. Harris's testimony and the impact that this legislation would make.
Thank you for the opportunity. For the record, my name is Angela Harris. I was stabbed while returning borrowed items at the Lusac Library on Sunday afternoon, February 13, 2022. I have met with many of you this week and in my previous trips to Juneau this session. I would like to thank the committee for hearing Senate Bill 53. I want to provide the details of my experience for the record and respond to some parts of the conversations that I've been having with elected officials in the Capitol since the session. My assailant, Corey Lee Vakovat, drove a dirty Leatherman knife into my spine between L2 and 3, penetrating my spinal cord. Mr. Akovac was located and arrested by APD later that afternoon while I was awaiting emergency surgery to remove the knife and the blood clots that damaged the nerve bundle and my spinal cord. The stabbing left me paralyzed from the waist down and with decreased strength and sensation in my upper extremities. I was unable to live in my home until we made modifications in our house to become handicapped accessible and safe for me to navigate. To this day, in addition to fighting for legislation, we're still working on the flooring of our home, in part due to delayed systems and shortage of supplies. My parents flew in from the lower 48 to live in our home with my two youngest children for 8 months. They're here with me today as we should be preparing for my son's high school graduation. My significant other had to quit his slope job to be my primary caretaker. I'm now on a long road to recovery. I attended physical therapy and occupational therapy 5 days a week for approximately 9 months. I see a counselor no less than twice a week to help work through the PTSD of my assault. Mr. Akovic has a history of assaulting women. In 2018, he violently attacked his mother with a frying pan. He attacked two other women on December 10, 2021. He was declared incompetent and not restorable, and he was released back into the public January 6, 2022, after being held for only 28 days. My assault was 38 days after his release. After my stabbing on February 13, 2022, he was declared incompetent and may be released back into the public after his next competency hearing. We need improvements to the state's mental health system, particularly regarding violent offenders, and we need to close the loophole in current laws that allow people to commit violent crimes only to be released back into our community. It should not be left up to the victims to pursue a civil commitment if their assailant is being released due to incompetence. Senate Bill 53 closes the loophole for dangerous individuals like Mr. Akovac. Senate Bill 53 is written to target a very narrow group of individuals like the man who assaulted me. It's my belief that jail is an inappropriate placement for Mr. Akovac, given his serious mental illness. As the survivor of his assault, I also believe that the community is also an improper placement. I've heard the concerns about protecting civil liberties in this legislation, and I do share your concerns. We must prioritize the rights of victims to live safely in our communities while allowing individuals who need long-term care to receive it. This is why I've been working with the administration on a weekly basis since August of last year. The Department of Law, both criminal and civil divisions, the Department of Family and Community Services, and API, the Public Defender Agency, the Disability Law Center, and court systems have all been involved with the legislation before you and have made important changes to strengthen this bill. We need to give victims more peace. As I work towards healing, it is difficult for me to live with the reality that my assailant could be released back into the community after his next hearing. I attended several block hearings and was appalled at how often individuals were released from custody just because the wait list for restoration was too long and it violated the civil liberties of the offender. Why is there not appropriate money being put towards this important process? If an individual can regain competency, the state should be putting money towards that so they can be charged criminally for their violent acts. If they cannot retain competency, there needs to be a long-term placement option for individuals who have repeatedly caused violent harm in our community. It's not fair to them or the victims of their violent acts to allow them to cycle through the system over and over again with no improvements to their mental health state whatsoever. My assailant has been in and out of the state's criminal and mental health system for decades. At what point do we give him more? If I were not on active duty at the time with the U.S. Coast Guard of my assault, then I would have very limited resources, and I cannot imagine the ruins of other Alaskans who have experienced similar assaults. As the perpetrator, Mr. Akovac, he has more rights, options, and resources at his disposal than I do as his victim. I was assaulted in February 2022. I filed a request with the Victims Crime Compensation Board in May of 2022. I received my first response from the Victims Compensation Board on April 12, 2023, offering me $3,000 for mental health services. Approximately 1 year later, what are we doing with our people? The amount of money, the amount of time, that felt insulting. I later spoke with Victoria Shanklin, who's the former director for Victims for Justice, and she apologized for the delay. She explained that they're embarrassingly behind and they are working with an outdated system and a limited budget, as they've not had a budget increase since 1976. My assault is an example of why we need to build up mental health facilities and our state laws to get violent offenders the help that they need and to keep our community safe. API serves our entire state, yet they're operating on a very limited capacity with a maximum of 80 beds with only 10 designated for restoration. I've learned that the number of beds actually available have been far less than that at times, and API has actually had periods of operating on a very decreased capacity. We must address the common element of inadequate mental health services for violent offenders and their victims. I just shared with you my experience in navigation through this process, and I share this with you and all fellow Alaskans to emphasize that we must close the loopholes that allow violent offenders to victimize more innocent Alaskans. The moment an offender commits a violent act against a fellow citizen, then their rights should be weighed against the victim's rights for safety. I understand raising concerns, but I ask that you please answer your concerns with a solution to the problem rather than just an opposition. I was told by the state DA that Mr. Akovac could have murdered me and still been released and could continue this cycle because there is nowhere else for him to go. The urgency that I have approached this bill with is because I'm scared that this can happen to another Alaskan if we don't act right now. My experience exposed a loophole in the statute that can have a devastating impact on our communities. I'm a firm believer that everything happens for a reason, and I know that Jesus has a purpose for this situation. Perhaps he's placed me before you to assist in preventing this tragedy from happening to any of you or your loved ones. With that being said, I intend to share my story while I continue to attend my therapy appointments, heal physically and emotionally, with the hopes of reducing the amounts of senseless violent assaults. The bill presented here today is the opportunity for you in your elected positions to make changes that are beneficial for all Alaskans, whether the victim of an assault due to mental illness or the victim of an untreated mental illness that results in violence against others. This bill is a good starting point, and I encourage each of you to learn more about the issues and find solutions to prevent what happened to me from happening to anyone else. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Harris, and for your availability with not only the executive branch but the legislature to answer questions and for your advocacy for victims. Do we have any questions from committee members? Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. It's for Senator Klayman. Senator Klayman, you're an attorney right now?
Yes.
Good. Then I can have some questions. Through the chair, I understand the violent assault, but what about those individuals? I was on the assembly when this had happened. I'm concerned that after this had happened to Ms. Harris, there were other incidents with other people at that same location. I'm fully aware of an individual that was, I guess you could call it, sucker punched. And then they were claiming that they were mentally ill, too. And I believe the person was. How far does this bill go? Because if you sucker punch somebody, they could hit their head. They can have injury weeks later, months later. How can we address it so it encompasses all? I know how important this legislation is, but I also want to make sure that it's airtight.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, what this legislation seeks to do is to strike the best balance we believe possible between requiring individuals that have an appropriate level of violent criminal history to be put into the process of an involuntary commitment and make sure the very gap that occurred in Ms. Harris's case does not occur in the future. That's what the legislation does. You, I think, raise a different question, which is how do we protect the community from individuals who may be suffering from significant mental illnesses who may engage in criminal conduct? And that's a challenge that we face both in terms of the resources we allocate for police and the laws that we have in place. But we, I think, will continue no matter what we legislate. There's constitutional protections that say a person that is incompetent to be brought to trial, we can't bring them to trial. That's the whole point of the competency restoration effort.
Can I do a quick follow-up? Yeah. Yes, but at the same time, Senator Klayman, I just want to make sure that if someone physically is mentally ill but physically lashes out or hurts another person, I'm just trying to figure out a way we can throw that in here. I know it's kind of a loose, but I want to make sure that it doesn't continue to happen. And then I'll have one other follow-up.
Through the chair, I believe as to individuals who have a history of felony conduct, which mm-hmm. is what this is focused on, that it closes that gap. And again, I think it does exactly that.
Thank you. Can I follow thank up? You? Yes. Ms. Harris, and this is for Senator Klayman, because you're going to know a little bit more of the detail. No offense, Ms. Harris. She had mentioned Victoria in a department. Can you give me a little bit more on that? What department? What department does it fall under? And how is she funded? By the MOA? By the state? Can we get, and you don't have, you can leave the name out. I just need
through the chair. Actually, Ms. Harris can answer this question
okay.
better than me.
All right.
Well, not specifically, but Victoria was with the Victims for Crime for quite some time through her own experiences. And when she called me, she had explained that she recently had taken a job with the state somewhere under the same realm and is still fighting the same type of fight, doing the same type of work, but at a state level. Whereas I believe Victims for Justice may be a sort of nonprofit.
Okay. Can I do it? Yes. Thank you. Through the chair. So, and I know who the victims of justice are, and I think they run on grants and donations and stuff. So, is that the department that delayed your $3,000 for being a victim to crime? No.
I can read my email to accurately address that, but I do know that it was through the Victims for Justice and the state website that I had filed the claim.
Through the chair, I think that the Victims for Justice is the nonprofit. I think the compensation she received is from the Victims Compensation Fund, which is a state-run fund, and we appropriate money to it.
Thank you.
Most years, and I'm probably getting that specific provision, but it's the Victims Crimes Compensation Fund that's a state fund.
Follow up?
Yes, through the chair. Does that fall under HESS? Where does that fall under? I know. This is it. I know. Because I'm trying to figure out where I'm going with this is that can't happen, and that needs to be addressed as well.
May I?
Absolutely.
I don't know all the appropriate. So she and I have spoken in detail on the phone at that point, and that is one of the asks that next legislation, she's going to construct some information and help me put together some sort of request. The systems that she's using is heavily outdated. For example, I filled out my crimes for the request through the Victims Compensation Board through MyAlaska, and it asked for a signature page. And whereas when you fill out your PFD and you electronically sign, you don't have that option within the victim's crime compensation request. So you have to then print, if you are fortunate to have the accessibility to do so, print, sign, and send back separately. What she also explained to me is all of the information that I filled out through the MyAlaska, it doesn't automatically transfer to a database. They have to pull that information and populate that into a different system. So you are not wrong. It is a very inadequate process and system. This bill doesn't address that because the only thing that I personally have the emotional bandwidth to deal with right now is prevention. But we will prayerfully next session come back and ask for some updates to those systems as well.
May I make a comment? Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that a yes?
Can we reserve comments until later?
It's two sentences, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Please continue.
It will be addressed. It's a huge concern of mine. And the other thing I wanted to say was thank you, Senator Klayman, for bringing this forward. And Angela, you know where my heart is.
Representative Gray.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to address a comment to Ms. Harris, and then I have two questions about Section 13 and then one question about Section 1. I knew we recognized each other. Ms. Harris pointed out today how we had known each other in the past. I knew you could walk. I'm really sorry. This is really hard. I just want to say that I feel like it's a conflict of interest. I'm going to have to ask a lot of questions about this bill, but it's not because I'm incredibly sorry for what happened. I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. I want to start with Section 13. Well, Section 13. It says that the professional person in charge may not discharge respondents who meet the standard of dangers set forth in legislation. My question is to the maker of the bill. Was that previously the law? Is this new? I'm questioning about this particular section stating that the person, and I assume the professional person in charge is a psychiatrist or a doctor in charge of the facility, that they are forbidden from an early discharge.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, it is not that they are forbidden. just requires that before the release takes effect, they have to give a 10-day notice. And I believe it's in AS 4737-85. Is it 785? I think it's in 75. There's provisions about early release in current statute. And in that provision, that also has the release doesn't become effective until 10-day notice. So they have to provide notice, and then 10 days later, they can release the person.
Follow up. The chair. So this is just restating what's already in statute. Is that correct? Or is it changing it?
Through the chair, it's not changing it, but because this has a slightly different circumstance, it's taking the same standard that is in existing statute and applying it to this situation.
And through the chair, follow up. Am I to understand that this is like a safeguard so that the psychiatrist can't say that someone's well and let them out early because they might be pressured because they don't have enough beds, for example, and they might want to open up a bed, and so they may be pressured to rule somebody safe for release too soon?
I believe there's an attorney from the civil division or the criminal division that should be available. That may provide more detail through the chair, but I think the basic answer is that, and again, the civil division would provide more in criminal division, but my general understanding is that when you have somebody that has engaged in certain serious criminal conduct, that if they're going to be discharged because they think they're now safe to be in the community, they want to give the prosecutor time to decide whether to refile the charges based on their belief they may be competent. And so that 10-day period would allow the prosecutor's office to file criminal charges and then to make a determination. You're here. Oh, you've got somebody on the line. I would actually ask for a...
Can we ask that?
We do. We have a phone a friend. We have Assistant Attorney General from the Criminal Division, Mr. John Skidmore, online. And then I believe we do have Civil Division. We also have courts here. So take your pick.
Okay. Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Skidmore. Is Senator Clayman's understanding of this particular statute correct, that the main purpose of not allowing the professional person to do the early discharge is to allow 10 days for the prosecutor to be able to press criminal charges?
Through the chair, this is John Skidmore to Representative Gray. The 10-day waiting period, I believe, is to provide time for a petition to be filed or charges to be filed if someone's going to be discharged civilly, for us to evaluate should criminal charges be refiled, which is the way I believe Senator Clayman stated it. And I agree with them that is the purpose behind it, is to give us a chance to review that and determine whether or not statute of limitations has run, whether or not we believe that this person has regained competence, all the sorts of things that we would have to evaluate and screen in order to make an informed decision about whether or not refiling charges is appropriate for that particular defendant in that particular case.
Follow up.
Through the chair, and this might be a question back to Senator Clayman, but so is this type of detention not happening at all right now? When we talk about Ms. Harris's case, where somebody had committed this sort of assault and then was released, is it because that's not happening at all? And this is something new that will be happening, where there will be potential criminal charges when they're deemed safe enough for release because they're now competent? I need some clarification.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, prior hearings, we've heard from the department that there are currently 10 individuals who have been involved in criminal conduct, who are believed to be dangerous, and are in what we would describe as repeating 180-day commitment cycles. There's 10 of those individuals are subject to involuntary commitment orders I believe the longest period one of them has been in the custody department for approximately 9 years. I would defer to the psychologist from the Alaska Psychiatric Institute who did testify at Senate Finance. But so people are being held involuntarily based on their psychiatric condition and findings of dangerousness to themselves or others.
Follow up.
So as I understand your answer through the chair, it's currently now it's like 180 days and they renew after every 180 day period.
Through the chair, yes.
Follow up.
So in her case, her assailant through the chair did not get 180 days.
Through the chair, Mr. Akovac is one of the 10 people that is subject to the involuntary commitment today. And he has not been released since he attacked Ms. Harris. And there were criminal charges that were brought, and they were again determined that he was incompetent to stand trial. But in contrast to the attack that occurred approximately 2 months before he attacked Ms. Harris, after this attack at the LUSAC library, the department, the civil division, did file involuntary commitment proceedings more or less at the same time as his criminal charges were dismissed. And so he has been attending. He remains involuntarily committed. And just in terms of context, it wasn't the question you asked, but he has been waiving his right to a confidential hearing, and Ms. Harris has been able to attend by telephone his involuntary commitment proceedings so far.
Follow up. I think my understanding is that he had done an assault just a couple months before through the chair with Ms. Harris. So my question is what was the ruling from the previous assault that he was not competent for criminal charges but was also not detained?
Through the chair.
Please,
this is Angela Harris. Representative Gray, I was still in the hospital when these things were taking place, and learning that he could be discharged, my family was very persistent in communications with the DA, the Attorney General, trying to figure out, this isn't right, what can we do? At which point the state educated my family that a civil commitment request could be made. And because I believe that because of my family's efforts is the reason that this situation is what it is, and he is still in custody.
Thank you. Senator Klayman, I think Representative Gray's trying to get to identifying the loophole that is the nexus for the bill. Would you describe where we're at between the criminal and the civil and give us that bigger picture?
So thank you, Madam Chair. The key portion of the legislation that addresses the topic you ask about is it's section 6, which is the new statute, 473706. And so that the gap that exists today is that when an individual is found incompetent to stand trial currently, it doesn't say who is responsible for filing the civil commitment process. And so what section 706 facilitates is it basically says you take one of the individuals that meets the definition of dangerousness. These are felony assaults against the person and felony arson. And if there's one of those charges, then it's no longer an option. It requires the prosecutor, before the charges are dismissed in the criminal case, to file the petition that initiates the civil commitment process. So the very gap that existed prior to Angela's assault and was actually there after her assault, but the earlier event that happened in December with Mr. Akovac, they dismissed the charges, and even though he had a prior history involving felony assaults against the person against his mother, there was no civil petition filed at that time. Were this law in place, were the bill in place, then what would have happened back in December was the prosecutor would have looked at Mr. Akovac's criminal history and would have said he has a prior felony assault, in this instance against his mother, He has a prior felony assault, so the law requires me to file a civil commitment petition, and that would initiate a civil commitment procedure.
So, in essence, it puts the responsibility onto the state rather than the victim. Is that an accurate assessment?
Partially. In fact, under current law, the state could file a petition. A hospital could file a petition. The victim could file a petition, but it's not, and others could file a petition, but there's nothing that requires anyone to take that action, and that's the two parts is, does the defendant meet this definition of dangerousness? And if they do, then it says, prosecutor, I mean, just a little bit of a side, when they're in these this question about competency, it's not a mystery when they come in on the day, like, where are we? Have they been able to restore them? I mean, they don't suddenly walk in for a 3 o'clock hearing and suddenly discover, oh my goodness, the person didn't get restored. They pretty well know what's coming, so it's not very difficult to file the paperwork. And with the structure, the court will have a form that's fairly straightforward to fill out, one or two pages, they'll fill it out. You know, the judge will say, did you want to file a petition? And then, oh yeah, I'll file the petition. So the difference today under the law without this legislation is that it's not clear who has that responsibility to file the petition, and this does put it squarely on the prosecutor's office.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for John Skidmore, if he's on.
Mr. Skidmore.
So, Mr. Skidmore, I have a question concerning the Department of Law. And the question is specifically, why does the Department of Law not file involuntary commitment paperwork on all defendants found incompetent to stand trial?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, everyone who is found incompetent to stand trial on any criminal charges would not necessarily meet the criteria for civil commitment. For example, if you had somebody that had committed the crime of theft, or more precisely, had engaged in the conduct of taking property but was found incompetent, that person would not be deemed a danger to themselves or others and would not qualify for a civil commitment process. Beyond that, the statutes didn't place an obligation on us to be the ones to be taking the actions in a crime that involved assault. That's not to say that there weren't cases in which we never filed petitions. We have on occasion filed petitions, but it was not something that we were regularly doing. It was not something that was placed on us as this is your responsibility to be pursuing civil commitments. What SB 53 changes is that it clearly indicates in those cases identified in the bill, namely felony assaults or felony crimes against a person, I should say, in addition to felony arsony cases, those are the ones in which the person has engaged in conduct that is deemed to be dangerous. And when somebody is found mentally incompetent, then that is a basis to have concern that they may have a mental illness that would also qualify them. That's not always the case, but what this bill would do is it would require prosecutors in the criminal division to file a petition to have an evaluation conducted of that defendant before the case is dismissed to determine, do they meet those civil criteria for commitment?
Follow up. Thank you for that lengthy answer. I guess I need to rephrase my question. So why would the Department of Law not file involuntary commitment on all of the cases where the defendant is being tried for a violent crime, assault or otherwise, and is found to be incompetent to stand trial?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the cases in which that has not occurred, I would submit, are likely because prosecutors were not previously trained to file such petitions. They are not necessarily ones that handle civil commitments. And part of what this bill does is it will place the responsibility on us to ensure that those prosecutors are trained about what that process is and how to file those petitions.
Follow up.
Mr. Skidmore, does the Department of Law require the statute to be changed in order for the Department of Law to train its employees to file those petitions when it makes sense to do so?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, the law does not need to be changed in order for us to conduct training, but the law does need to be changed if it is going to become part of our responsibility, part of our duty, to be in the ones that file those petitions. We're not required to, we could, but we're not required to. When the law indicates that we're required to, then that's one of those things that we ensure absolutely happens. Prior to that, our focus is on the prosecution of the crimes, and when the prosecution is ended, then we shift our focus to the other crimes that we need to prosecute.
Follow up.
So if there are cases in which Department of Law has filed petitions for involuntary commitment on cases where defendants are found incompetent to stand trial for violent crimes, and the law didn't require it, and it's within the power of the administration to direct its employees, train its employees to do so, I'm failing to understand why the law has to be changed in order to force the Department of Law to do what it can already do. And I asked the question previously why you wouldn't do it in that case. And you gave me an answer of maybe somebody wasn't trained properly, but I'm just trying to understand why, if it's already possible, why are we looking to the law to force the Department of Law to do something that they're already capable of doing?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, placing the responsibility on members of the Department of Law says this is their obligation. This is their responsibility. Without that statute in place, it remains that anyone could file this. That does not definitively fall upon our folks to engage in that conduct. And so that becomes an additional duty that the public essentially would hope that we would engage in, but that's not specifically assigned to us. And under those circumstances, it's difficult for us to take those on. Part of what happens within this bill is that when you place the responsibility on us, there is also a fiscal note that allows us to ensure that we have the appropriate resources to do precisely what it is I think you would like us to do. Without the bill, without the fiscal note, that would be another conversation to have with others within the administration about how to appropriately resource that.
And follow up on a different topic.
Follow up, and then we have a couple more in the queue.
Okay, thank you. The two-year commitment, what's the purpose of the commitment? Is it to treat the individual, or is it the purpose to treat them to be able to stand trial? And I'm not sure who I'm addressing this question to.
Why don't I give the first try at that, and if you want more, you've got many good options. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, the first part about the two-year commitment is it would only follow after an individual has been ordered to a 30-day commitment, a 90-day commitment, and a 180-day commitment. So the two-year commitment only comes after they've done the first three in succession. They can't start out saying two-year commitment. The purpose of the two-year commitment is, let me give that the reasons. I couldn't remember if it was two or three, so I'll just. The first is to provide a greater level of assurance to victims like Ms. Harris. I can't underestimate how much stress it puts on her every 6 months to listen to a hearing to see whether Mr. Akovic is going to be held for the next 6 months. And so in terms of providing a level of assurance to victims the extended commitment for people that meet that standards of dangerousness is essential, I think, to giving them greater assurance and helping them heal. The second is that when a hospital like the Alaska Psychiatric Institute is looking at treatment, somebody they're going to have in holding for up to 2 years and say the court has ordered a two-year commitment, they may look differently at their treatment plan for that individual because they're not going to be looking at the next round in 6 months, but instead they'll say, okay, for somebody that has serious mental illness, has serious dangerousness to the community, can we provide better treatment option on a two-year plan than on a six-month plan? And so I think that's a second part. And then I think the third part about why we've put this in the bill is just that it I think gives the public the assurance that we really can be paying more attention to the public safety factors of the most dangerous individuals and how we're both caring for them, but also providing protection for the public. And then the last part, which is not part of the reasons for the two-year, but the two-year commitment only relates to involuntary commitment. At that point, a person has already been found incompetent to stand trial, and the criminal charges have been dismissed. It's possible that at the conclusion of their civil commitment, they might look to see whether they're competent again, but my general understanding from the providers is that it's unlikely they'll be returned to competence.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. It seems that if justice is to be served, why would the original case just be automatically dropped if there is a chance that they're going to become competent? If that's the purpose of the 30, 90, 180, and two-year involuntary commitment is to make them better, for lack of a better word, but to overcome their incompetence, then wouldn't the purpose of that commitment at that point be to make them competent to stand trial?
Through the chair, I'll give you the short answer, and then I'd actually ask you, Mr. Skidmore, to add a little more detail. But the civil commitment is not a criminal process. They only get to civil commitment because they've been unable to restore the person to competence, and under constitutional principles, we can't prosecute somebody who's incompetent. But Mr. Skidmore, I think, can give you a lot more detailed answer to that question.
Mr. Skidmore.
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, the two-year commitment is not for purposes of restoring competency. There are two different processes that occur under the law. When somebody is charged criminally and are found incompetent, there is a period of time that statute authorizes to attempt to restore that person to competency. When that process has failed, we cannot restore them to competency, then there is a separate civil commitment process that is not about incompetence or restoring competency, but rather is about the individual being a danger to themselves or others and is therefore involuntarily committed to treat the mental illness that makes them a danger. It is possible to treat the mental illness and to have them get better so that they are not a danger, but still not be competent. What the bill attempts to do, however, is to also allow the criminal division to evaluate an individual whose mental illness has been treated such that they are no longer a danger to themselves or others, because while it may be possible that they have not been restored to competency, it is also possible that they would have been. And it's at that point we would be able to make determinations about whether or not we should be reinstituting, recharging that criminal case. But they are different purposes. And so the precise question I think you asked is the two-year commitment's purpose to restore competency? And the direct specific answer is no, it's not. It's to try and make that person no longer a danger to themselves or others.
And I guess the logical follow-up is that once somebody becomes competent, if they're successfully become competent, then they don't necessarily get charged for the original crime.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, if somebody is restored to competency before the criminal case is dismissed, we continue with the prosecution. If the person was found unrestorable at that time and the criminal case was dismissed, and then the person is civilly committed, and at a later time, the civil commitment, it's determined, is no longer necessary because the person is no longer a danger, at that time, we would evaluate whether or not we could prosecute the person. And there is a host of factors we would have to evaluate.
Representative Groh, and then we will circle, keep circling to those who haven't had an opportunity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Ms. Harris, obviously what has occurred has been terrible, awful, and beyond belief. And I'm also struck by both the terrible trauma that you faced and then the awareness that your actual experience of learning what the status of the offender was and was actually, you know, the being released or had been released. And as I said before, when I talked to you before, I think what you've done is very impressive. I wanted to ask some questions both, you know, might be some for Senator Klayman, and also for some of the other experts we have available. I guess I'd like a better understanding, more precisely, of what various, the Department of Law, the court system, Senator Klayman, believes is the actual universe of people we've talked about. I've heard a number of 10 individuals who are repeating an involuntary commitment cycles. I guess there'd be some people, I guess, who might, I guess, including perhaps the offender at the time that he had attacked Ms. Harris, he would not be in the cycle, right? He would have been released. So I guess I'd like a better understanding, and maybe we can do a sort of concentric circles of a target. There's some people who have already been caught, right? And there's another category of people who are like the offender in this case, right, at the time of the attack. So I'd like, like I said, perhaps I see the general counsel of the court system here. I know that Mr. Skidmore is on the line. Mr. Senator Klayman's here at the table. But get a better understanding from various people who've studied this, you know, how large is the universe of cases we're talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, the first part of the answer is that were this law in place in December when the man who attacked Ms. Harris attacked the other women, because he had in his history assaultive conduct that was of a felony level, that the state would have had to file an involuntary commitment petition upon dismissal. And so instead of him being released to the community, that process would have been initiated. In terms of the statistics, I think the best source of that is Ms. Mead, who is here from the court system. I think she can provide an idea of the number of folks that are up for restoration, and I think the statistics you're asking about.
Ms. Mead.
Thank you. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I do have data, and if you could repeat exactly what numbers you're looking for.
There's, I guess, two obvious categories are people that are now in involuntary involuntary commitment cycles, and then there's the precise number of people who were in the category of Ms. Harris's attacker. People who were, by definition, at the time that he attacked Ms. Harris, was not in, you know, involuntarily committed. People that are adjudicated incompetent and then are not, are not in otherwise in custody after that adjudication.
Through the chair to Representative Groh, the most probably direct number you're looking for then is we're looking at between 70 to 90, maybe 100 individuals in FY22 who were charged with a felony crime against a person, who had a competency evaluation, and whose cases were subsequently dismissed. Those 100 people charged with a felony crime against a person would, under this bill, be segued after the criminal case is dismissed into an evaluation for a civil commitment under the civil Title 47. There were many more competency orders, that is, in a criminal case where somebody, the defense, said, my client is incompetent. That happened about 400 times last year. About 140 of those were felonies, so some were misdemeanors, certainly. They wouldn't be covered by this bill at all. And then some of those, after a competency evaluation, are found competent, about a third of those. So we're kind of getting down. Very few of those actually end up at API, but the main reason is because the lack of beds at API. So if somebody is found incompetent to stand trial, they get put on a wait list for the 10 beds. That's the number you heard, 10. And the wait list now is something like 4 months long. So many of those cases get dismissed if, for example, the person is never going to make it to API. And that is the statutory requirement that that case then be dismissed.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in terms of the problems, I think it's really important to look at how much of the problem and to what degree the problem is caused by a gap in the law, which you know this bill would seek to fill, and how much is caused by a lack of treatment. And then there's been some discussion here that, and as you've alluded to, Ms. Mead, that there's essentially some attempt to put in, and I don't know that all 70 or 100 people would be seeking to be having treatment at one time. But some large number of people, large, a number that is larger than 10, are being put on into attempted to be treated in 10 beds at API and leading to what you have described here this afternoon as a 4 month wait list. Is my question making sense in terms of the relationship between the law and the services?
Through the chair to the representative, Grow. Let me try to separate these a little bit better because I think I've confused you. The 10 beds at API has 80 beds. The 10 I speak of, those are criminal beds. So those are used in a criminal case when somebody claims incompetency, deemed incompetent. Let's try to get them better. And that whole criminal case is open during that whole time. Those are restoration beds, criminal restoration beds. They are full, those 10 beds. And there is a 4 month wait and there's some triaging. So the more serious people get the beds, et cetera. So that is the reason many criminal cases get dismissed for incompetency. The person never makes it, or indeed they attempt incompetent or restoration and it just doesn't work. Now, 100 of those dismissed cases under this bill would go to the other 70 beds at API for an evaluation. And those evaluations can occur at other places other than API. I think Bartlett does them, Matt Sue has a place now, maybe Fairbanks. That's limited, but there is not a huge bottleneck to get the evaluation that this bill would require, that civil evaluation, to see if that person meets the completely different standard to be mentally committed. So there is incompetency to stand trial. Those individuals will not necessarily be mentally ill and likely to cause serious harm to self or others. They're two completely separate standards and different things happen under those two.
Follow up. Do we have any sense of how many cases are like the ones over time or over a period, or like the ones that of the offender that Ms. Harris, in the sense that people who for which there was finding of incompetence, and then there was no attempt to have a civil commitment?
Through the chair to Representative Grow, we do not have data on that, and I think Mr. Skidmore testified that nobody had that duty. In some cases, it certainly happened. For example, it happened after the incident with Ms. Harris. But in most cases, I can say with certainty, when a criminal case is dismissed for a finding of incompetency, even when it's an 1141, many, many of those don't have a Title 47 civil case filed. Sometimes the DA or others would consider, well, they're not going to meet that standard, because remember, it's a completely different standard. but I don't know how many you could say sort of should have had one but did not. I don't know the answer.
One moment. I'd like to let the record reflect. At 4:26, we were joined by Representative Johnson. Representative Groh, one more follow-up, and we still have others in the queue who have not gotten a bite of the apple.
Then I have a broader and a narrow question. I'll go with the broader question, which I think is for Senator Klayman, the sponsor. Ms. Harris's case is obviously involves an attack on someone else other than the offender in terms of the risk was to someone else, tragically, than the offender. And obviously we had references to other cases where there were felony assaults and other. But the law, the proposed legislation addresses risk to self as well. I'm aware that there's a whole bunch of people, and I've had a brief conversation with Representative Gray, who said this more from a medical practitioner. There's a whole number of people who are risk to themselves or not risk to others or do not, by all experience, seem to be. And I was somewhat, I was interested in your, how you would address the proposed legislation's treatment of, in terms of people with risk that they present both to the others as well as themselves as well as to others.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, in there were two parts. First is that people who are suicidal, there are no felony crimes involving people who are suicidal towards themselves. There's a limited number of felony crimes that involve trying to get somebody else to kill themselves. But in terms of the felony, suicide itself is not a felony crime. And in look, and I think in large measure, this, my understanding, and again, that may be more appropriate directed to the Commissioner of Public Safety, or you could probably get a similar answer from the Anchorage Police Department. I think in large measure, people who are suicidal are not being taken to jail for crimes. They're being taken in for involuntary commitment on the typical involuntary commitment cycle. And part of the policy choice we made in proposing this legislation is to distinguish those who are a risk of themselves to others, a risk to others versus a risk to themselves. If they're a risk to others, that they would be people that might would be eligible for the 2-year involuntary commitment, whereas people that are attempting to be a potential harm to themselves wouldn't be able to qualify for that 2-year involuntary commitment. They would, of course, still qualify under danger to self under the 6-month rotating involuntary commitments.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. My question is to Ms. Harris through the chair. I have it on good authority that your coworkers speak very highly of you and were sorely missed after your assault. I don't know that we've had a chance to interact personally, but I want to ask a question which might seem counterintuitive. I know you're here on behalf of this legislation. I know that there will be benefits if we were to pass this legislation. I also know that as the legislature, when a prosecutor or a judge drops the ball, when a prosecutor accepts a plea agreement that is low and then someone gets out and someone's raped or murdered, it's very easy for those in our criminal justice system to say, it's not my fault, it was the law's fault, and then blame the law. To the extent that the law is at fault in the situation, could you also speak to, are there other things at fault as well? I mean, you know your situation very well. To what extent should we be focusing specifically on the law versus the fact that there are human actors in our justice system which make mistakes or bad conduct? Can you help us understand, since we have you here before us today?
The chair, Representative Eastman, could you narrow your question for me?
Yes. I know what's publicly available about your case, and I'm wanting to know, we could be focusing on prosecutors and their conduct. We could be focusing on judges and their conduct. We could be focusing on rewriting a law, any one of which could have helped prevent what happened to you or could have made your experience better in some way. In your experience, were there judges at fault? Were there prosecutors at fault? Was the law at fault? Or was it the case where simply fixing this law would have solved the problem? And if you can't answer that, I totally understand. But since I have you here in front of me right now, I'm asking for your insight.
Through the chair, the judge that released Mr. Akovac in the beginning is the same judge that was releasing him now. And I, during my testimony in that hearing, I said how I felt about it. I have spent much time trying to heal emotionally, physically, and this piece of the legislation regarding prevention is the only thing that I've had the bandwidth to dive into deeply. I have learned that what I call a large elephant of inadequacies within the systems are present. I understand that there are a lot more victims that were not as fortunate as me to be active duty military and do not have the care that they deserve. Unfortunately, the situations when you're assaulted by someone in a public place and you don't have the means to care for yourself, they sometimes crawl in a hole, and I've met some of those people, unfortunately, who have shared experiences with me that can't fight for themselves or their family. So I'll say that this part of legislation regarding prevention is the only thing that I've really been able to dive into. I am learning and touching on different areas. That, yes, I do feel that I've been failed. This thing should have been fixed a long time ago. I loved hearing you say it will happen. It has to happen. I understand funding. I understand resources. But I wonder at what point is it going to be worth it to save Alaska before we start having to dig ourselves out of a hole? Why not start right now where we are? So there are a lot of areas that need to be addressed to alleviate the situation. I just honestly barely have the bandwidth to be here.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate that you're here. I know that that must be very, very difficult. So thank you very much for that. Follow up. My question next is for Mr. Skidmore through the chair. Mr. Skidmore, we talked about instances where someone is thought to have committed a crime, but they're not competent to stand trial. Maybe at some point in the future they are competent to stand trial. Given that many crimes have statutes of limitation, are those statutes of limitation in any way told during the period that someone's not competent to stand trial? Or does that effectively eat into the statute of limitations to the point where, you know, someone can, you know, spend their entire time incompetent and then come back competent, you know, shortly after the statute of limitations expires?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there is nothing about a civil commitment or attempts to restore somebody that tolls the statute of limitations.
Thank you.
The question would be whether or not the level of the offense carries a statute of limitations of 5 or 10 years, or whether the particular offense does not have a statute of limitations, in which case we can refile charges at any time.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
My next question is to the bill sponsor, Senator Klayman. There's, you know, we have a justice system that assumes innocence before someone is found guilty. And certainly if someone is incompetent to stand trial, legally speaking, they are incompetent and innocent because they've not been convicted of a crime. I know the bill recommends or would require that we dispense with the requirement for two psychologists instead of one. And I'm trying to weigh, partly better understanding what the motivation for that is, also weighing that against the fact that I have an individual who is innocent, and now we're talking about taking that person's freedom effectively as though they were guilty, but maybe not in a jail setting. And it would seem to me that, maybe some safeguards, maybe, a second opinion on the psychologist would be helpful to safeguarding truly innocent people from being caught up in these kinds of situations.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, you're talking about bill section number one. And bill section number one is actually in large measure, it's a cleanup provision that is unrelated to everything else about this legislation, because section number one addresses when a defendant raises the affirmative defense of insanity. That's a person who is presumably competent. There's no incompetency issue for that person. They're strictly in a setting in which they want to raise the affirmative defense of insanity. And the statute has been there for years that requires two psychiatric professionals, meaning either a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but to be appointed by the court and then provide a report about their mental state at the time of the crime. And there's two reasons, and I think Mr. Skidmore can provide further insight into this, but there's two reasons to make the amendment. First was that it turns out that for some years we have not had a psychologist in the state of Alaska that meets the American Board of Forensic Psychology standards. So anytime the court needed to find somebody, they had to go find an expert from outside Alaska. So that would be the first issue that came up. But the second one is that procedurally, when a person raises the defense of insanity, and it happens very rarely, the defense typically will, and it's usually a public defender, they will have funds that they will hire their own expert to do that evaluation. And so the single expert appointed by the court is adequate for the court's purposes, and the prosecutor may actually choose to hire their own independent expert and not use the court's expert. And the only one of the cases I am familiar with, I think there had been the first evaluation the court ordered, and neither of the parties realized there was a requirement of two. And 6 months later, somebody said, oh, look, I need to have a second evaluation. And so the court said, oh, yeah, you're supposed to have a second evaluation. So then things were delayed for 2 months while they did the second evaluation. And in that case, the two experts largely agreed with one another. The defense hired their own expert on the question, and the second expert really didn't add much to the picture. But I would invite Mr. Skidmore to add his perspective on that. But that was that topic was something that the Department of Law brought to our attention as we were working on the bill. And like a lot of things, we had a discussion about different features. And so what's in section number one reflects discussion between my office, the public defender's office, and the prosecutor's office.
Thank you. Follow-up?
I would like to note that we do have Stephen Bookman from, he's a human services attorney from the civil division of the Department of Law available. And I thank him for his availability as well. We've had some issues with the phone lines today. So follow-up, Representative Eastman.
Thank you.
You don't want to hear from Mr. Skidmore on this?
I don't, either way. But I have a question right now for the bill sponsor. And the question is, it would seem to me if a U.S. prosecutor, trying to put myself in the position of a prosecutor, were to expect that someone that I could potentially charge is going to be found incompetent, and there's not going to be a trial, and there's not going to be a guilt or innocence, that might be an incentive for filing charges that might not normally be found guilty. Because I know that no one is going to, there's not going to be a jury and judge to come back and say no, and that would trigger this process, and then the competency would be found and so forth. And I'm wondering, has there been discussion on that, and are there things in the bill or that we could do that would weigh against that potential incentive?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I just want to make sure you're asking, is there incentive for a prosecutor to look at potential criminal conduct and and choose the offense they charge the person with an eye towards that they might be found incompetent on the charge they bring against them?
No, my question deals with if you expect that a particular person before you is likely to be found incompetent, then you know that whatever charge you may offer or may not offer isn't likely to go to trial because of that. And you might be very careful to preserve your win-loss record or whatnot as a prosecutor in only charging things that you're quite confident you get convictions of. But now we're putting them in a situation where there isn't going to be a conviction. There isn't going to be a judge and jury. And so that might there's less reason for them to maybe be as careful in the charges that they go. And so we're putting together this list of charges which could trigger this process. And I'm just wondering if that potential has been, considered.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. I personally cannot imagine a circumstance in which any of our state prosecutors, or for that matter, any of our federal prosecutors in Alaska, and any of the prosecutors, even before I moved to Alaska, I clerked for the federal court in West Texas, and I can't think of a single prosecutor that would try to handicap their one lost record based on a concern that somebody might be found incompetent. I think they are going to prosecute exactly what they think are appropriate. I do think that a prosecutor, for example, a prosecutor who's seen Mr. Akovac before, he's been through the system before. If he were out and committed a crime, they might say, Mr. Akovac is back, and he's been found incompetent the last four times. I'm going to charge him with the offense that he committed, but I recognize our odds of finding him competent aren't very high, and I think they would enter the process with some realistic view that the odds that that person has improved psychiatrically aren't very high. But I would really ultimately defer to Mr. Skidmore. I think he can speak more to the duties of a prosecutor, and I think he should have an opportunity to answer Representative Eastman's question.
Mr. Skidmore.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Eastman, a prosecutor has ethical responsibilities to only file charges where there is appropriate evidence to support them. So it's not as though you're going to have a prosecutor that wants to file charges when there is no factual basis to support it. First, ethically, from a prosecutor's standpoint, that's the sort of thing that could cause us to lose our license to practice law. Second, whenever charges are filed, whether somebody is going to be found incompetent later or not, the courts have an obligation to review the factual basis and determine that there is probable cause to support those charges. And if there was probable cause, then that case should be dismissed. Third, our department actually has a higher standard. We don't want our folks filing charges unless they believe that they can prevail beyond a reasonable doubt in a case. And if somebody were filing charges when there wasn't sufficient or appropriate evidence to support them to begin with, then that could also result in employment actions on the behalf of the Department of Law. That is, we don't want to have a prosecutor that would be engaging in the type of conduct that you talked about. And if they did engage in that, that could have significant adverse consequences to their employment. So those are the three things that immediately come to my mind that are safeguards that are already in place that would protect against those sorts of conduct that you described.
Thank you.
In light of time, I'd like to note we have about 10 more minutes on this piece of legislation because we do have one more bill to be introduced, and we have members who have other committees. But we have one member who has not had an opportunity to ask any questions before I get to other members. So we will circle back around Vice Chair Allard and then Representative Gray.
Okay, so I'm going to say something. Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Harris, you're not going to like what I'm going to say. And probably most of the people in the state of Alaska aren't going to like what I'm going to say. The law, what I'm reading, I just got this yesterday, looking at everything. I got to be honest, there are minor changes in here. And I don't think these minor changes would have changed your circumstance. when I'm reading it and I'm looking at all this stuff, the law didn't fail you. Those who enforce the law failed you. From the judge to the prosecutor to the law department for the state of Alaska, they all failed you. My concern is that how are we going to fix it? We can pass this. That's not going to change your circumstance. What got you here today is your parents, your character, and the Coast Guard. Other people don't have that. I applaud you for being here today. The funding and the resources, not using those to prosecute your case, letting it slide through the cracks, it's obscene. So, Senator Klayman, through the chair, my question is, I have a couple, and I don't know if people can answer it that are here today. I know that some has to do with medication. The difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist, one. And then my other concern is going from one professional or going from two professionals to one for an evaluation, it's concerning to me.
So, through the chair, Representative Allard, I'm not sure I entirely understand your question about psychiatrists and psychologists. Psychiatrists can prescribe medication. They've been to medical school and they're licensed to prescribe medication. Psychologists have not been through medical school. They are not licensed to prescribe medication.
Follow up? Yeah, just quickly. I'm concerned because a lot of times when we get evaluated or if somebody says, you have cancer, you always want a second opinion. It's concerning that we go from one or from two to one.
And through the chair, Representative Allard, this is specific to the insanity defense. Mm-hmm. The insanity defense, that's essentially a statutory claim. It has nothing to do with the question of competence to stand trial and the evaluation process for competence to stand trial. In the process for competence to stand trial, the statute for years, and there's no change in this legislation, only requires an evaluation by one psychiatrist or psychologist as to whether or not they are competent to stand trial. We don't change that. With regard to the insanity defense, if your concern is that you want to have a second opinion, the answer is that in every case involving the defense, the affirmative defense of insanity, in every case that I'm aware of, and I've actually tried an insanity case many years ago in my career, there's always at least two opinions, and usually three, and sometimes four. And the fact that the court is only appointing one or two psychiatrists or psychologists doesn't mean that the defendant who's raising the defense of insanity doesn't get a second opinion. In fact, they always have a second opinion. I remember, and so that concern that there's not the second look and the prosecution, if the court appointed psychiatrist or psychologist says that they were not insane for purposes of the affirmative defense, the prosecution might well choose not to get a third opinion. But I would just say without any reservation that if the court opinion comes back and says insane at the time of trial, the prosecutor is likely to hire an expert to evaluate the defendant and say, and the likelihood is very good that the prosecution psychiatrist will say they are sane at the time. And what more often happens is the court appointed psychiatrist or psychologist finds that they were not insane at the time. And then the defense hires their own expert who offers the second opinion. And that person testifies and the jury gets to hear both experts. So if the concern is that the defendant doesn't get more than one person getting a look at their psychiatric state, I think the risk of that is very, very low. And on top of that, the defense of insanity, I would predict in the last 30 years, that defense has been probably raised at trial less than five times, and it might be as narrow as two or three. It's just very, very rarely raised.
Madam Chair, I just have one last question so I can understand something.
Follow up.
Thank you, through the chair. So on page 12, line 4, it says in underlying that this is the change number 10, the division of the Department of Law, that has responsibility for criminal cases as provided in AS 47.30.727. Who is now going to be responsible to making sure this doesn't happen to anyone else and it doesn't just get passed around because we don't have the funds, the revenue, nobody wants to take it on as a responsibility? Is that what that line is saying?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, the line added on that is subsection 10 in section 15 of the bill has to do with confidential records and what happens to the confidential records. And so what section 15, subsection 10 requires is that confidential records that are obtained by the Department of Law as part of this process, the Department of Law has an obligation to maintain the confidentiality of those records that they receive. It's essentially implementing HIPAA protections that would require the Department of Law that got things related to the involuntary commitment as in deciding whether to take a criminal prosecution, that they're not supposed to distribute those records.
Madam Chair, I promise. Last one. Thank you.
Last follow-up.
Okay, through the chair. Senator Kleeman, where in here does it say, help me out, because it's kind of just dropped on us, who is going to be responsible for enforcement? Because I heard, and John, or Mr. Skidmore is my favorite attorney in the state, by the way. No offense.
None taken.
But who is going to be the persons that are going to say, she's not going to fall through the cracks again? Neither is this person down the road, because that is exactly what happened. And without her support from the Coast Guard as being active military, her parents, God bless them, we don't know what would have happened to Angela.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, what the bill does is a person who has a history of certain violent crimes who is found incompetent to proceed, the responsibility will fall on the prosecutor to make sure civil charges are initiated. A different question I believe you ask is, okay, what about somebody who isn't active duty Coast Guard, who doesn't have significant support from their parents, who may not have health insurance, may not have strong family support, who is nevertheless attacked in exactly the same situation that Ms. Harris suffered? I think Ms. Harris's testimony was more compelling than anything I can say.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Harris. And
could I add, Madam Chair, specifically in the bill, through the chair? Oh, absolutely, yes. This is Emma Potter, staff to Senator Kleeman. Thank you for the reminder. Through the chair to Representative Allard, in the bill specifically, if you're wanting to read those sections, it's Section 4 and Section 6 taken together. Section 4 is in Title 47, which is the criminal code. And so it lists what the prosecutor has the responsibility to do. And then if you flip over to Section 6, it takes us over to the civil code. And that's where it actually gets into the civil commitment procedure or the procedure for the evaluation for civil commitment.
Thank you, Ms. Potter.
So we have one quick follow-up from Representative Gray, one by Representative Groh, and then we are going to have to set this bill aside to hear at another date, just due to time constraints. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, when someone's been committed for 24 months because they are deemed a danger to the public and they are unlikely to be reformed, at the end of that 24 months, is it assumed that we would renew for an additional 24 months and that would happen on into the future?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, there's nothing that prevents the department from filing another civil commitment petition at the 24-month mark.
Follow up. We have, through the chair, I heard a four-month wait list for API, for evaluation for embedded API. Where do folks go during that four-month period?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, those are the restoration beds in criminal cases, not to be confused with involuntary commitment beds, but it depends on whether they are out on bail or whether they are in jail. If they're in jail, they wait in jail if they haven't been able to bail out. And if they're not in jail, then they would wait out on bail. I would note one feature of the bill we haven't discussed, but Section 3 and Section 4 add, again, this was part of the work with the Department of Law, we wanted to add provisions so that for the ability for a court to allow somebody out on bail to go through the restoration, evaluation, and restoration process if the court believes they can do that safely out of custody, because that's, and I know there's efforts going on to try to provide more services for restoration so that there's there's more opportunities than just the 10 beds that are an inpatient treatment. If somebody could be restored in an outpatient basis, those sections allow that capacity to expand as they come up with resources.
Madam Chair, I promise to follow it fastest, and I will squish it all in. But through the chair, my fear is that there's sort of an unfunded mandate within the bill, and maybe you can dispel that, that if we're going to have additional people be held potentially indefinitely in, taking up beds, that we don't have the capacity for them, that passing this law is going to ask that certain people be kept for 24 months. And I just want to make sure that we have lots of facilities that can accommodate this.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, through the Department of Family and Community Services, in terms of the longer commitment period, did not submit a fiscal note indicating that would be additional costs for the longer period of commitment. Their perspective on that, I see Representative Allard's look, their perspective is that they actually have the people that would fall within that longer commitment they already have in their custody. I'm not sure custody is the right word, but they are already in API, and they don't believe that they would, that population would change.
Representative,
I'll be very
Grow.
Ask a different question, which is for you. For you, my question is, Chair Vance, what's the amendment deadline in this bill, and when will it be heard again?
I'm not setting an amendment deadline today because I believe that we have a lot more questions to ask before we can have the proper insight for what should be amended. And I am this time of session is an ever moving target, and I will be communicating with the committee the more information that we have. But I know we have so many other questions for so many people, and I want to thank Senator Klayman, your staff, Ms. Harris, for availability, for your testimony, for your work on this issue. I know that you've been working with many partners across the state to try to find what is the first step in the solution. So thank you for your work. And I know that Senator Klayman has made himself and his staff available for questions, as well as Ms. Harris is here as well. And I appreciate your vulnerability in working through this, and hope that you were able to have some sense of healing in this process as well. We truly do respect all that you are doing in working through this. So thank you so much. And we will set Senate Bill 53 aside and take a brief at ease to transition to our final agenda item. Back on the record, we will now move to our final agenda item today, and that is to receive a first hearing on House Bill 4, Elections Repeal the Ranked Choice Voting. And I would like to welcome my Chief of Staff, Jake Almeida, to introduce us to this bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jake Almeida, Chief of Staff to Rep Vance. I will just kind of go through some prepared remarks that the bill sponsor had given in the House State Affairs Committee where this bill was first heard and passed. This is a 62-section bill, and so we will refrain at this time from going through that specifically section by section, but obviously can take any specific questions members may have on it. The heart of it is that the bill repeals ranked choice voting that was passed in 2020 as a ballot initiative. And the provisions that this bill leaves alone from that ballot measure relate to the dark money provisions that Alaskans were told about. The ballot initiative obviously instituted a ranked choice voting system in Alaska's election system. It opened up the primaries to one ballot primary system, and it instituted protections for financial disclosures relating to dark money. So that is what the bill does. That is what the 62 sections consists of. but I will now walk through kind of the policy pitch per the sponsor's request. So the number one issue that the chair has heard from Alaskans this last year is to repeal ranked choice voting. This issue rose above the conversation of the BSA and the PFD, and it is the will of the chair to do the will of Alaskans. So the need to bring election reform comes from the outcry of the people of Alaska. For many years, voters have been highlighting the clear lack of trust in our election process. Many believe the concerns to be mere speculation, but the results could not be more clear than a 44% voter turnout in the 2022 general election, one of the lowest general election turnouts in our state's history. A recent poll conducted in April by Dittman Research shows that 51% of Alaskans want to repeal ranked choice voting, and 2% are still undecided. House Bill 4 repeals ranked choice voting and open primaries, returning the election process to the way Alaskans voted prior to ballot measure 2 of 2020, except for areas in statute the courts have found unconstitutional. This bill attempts to remedy the constitutional issues by providing for combined open primaries and omitting the requirement that party nominees be registered as a member of that party. The ballot measure that transformed Alaska's election system in 2020 passed by a narrow margin of less than 1%. The campaign led Alaskans to believe the ballot measure would do away with dark money, only that it would give them more options in voting. Most Alaskans did not know that it would upend the way of our voting has been, that one person equals one vote. Many voters have expressed buyer's remorse since passage. In fact, recent polling shows that the majority of Alaskans strongly agreed to repeal ranked choice voting. This bill allows combined primaries when two parties request jointly and implements court decisions in the State versus Democratic Party from 2018, holding that the requirement that candidates register with a party when seeking party nomination violates parties' free speech associational rights, and the State versus Green Party of Alaska in 2005, holding that prohibition on parties combining primary ballots under the system established in law is unconstitutional. So this bill respects both those pieces of case law. House Bill 4 seeks to implement the will of Alaskans by returning us to the historical and trusted election process where one person equals one vote, but leaves the dark money provisions in place that voters believed was the whole purpose of the ballot measure. That was the predominance of the radio ads, the written ads, the online ads. That is what the public, the chair's belief, if you were to poll 9 out of 10 Alaskans on the street, their understanding at the time of ballot measure 2 is that it was a ballot measure squarely about dark money, and little to no information was provided about the upending of our voting system that the ballot measure also did. So Alaskan voters believe that voting should be simple and easy to understand. Ranked choice voting is the opposite of that. About 1 in 8 rural Alaska ballots were rejected in the special congressional primary of 2022, with up to 17% of ballots being rejected due to a lack of signature or identifier. That means up to 17% of the votes were not counted. Ranked choice voting only adds more complication to an already disenfranchised voting population. Studies have shown that jurisdictions with higher proportions of older voters are more likely to report ballot marking mistakes, increasing the potential of their ballot being rejected. A group called Fair Vote, who is a proponent of ranked choice voting, found that, quote, the prevalence of ranking 3 candidates was lowest among African Americans, Latinos, voters with less education, and those whose first language was not English. Alaska has a high population of seniors, minorities, and people whose first language is not English. That could potentially struggle with fully utilizing a ranked choice voting ballot. Ranked choice voting has failed to increase voter turnout and provide more options to voters as promised. It has only increased voter confusion and disenfranchisement and has caused the lowest voter turnout in decades. It is time we return to the trusted process of truly where one person equals one vote. And I will close with a quote from a study done, a false majority, the failed experiment of ranked choice voting. Quote, democratic choice within the confines of our constitutional republic forms the bedrock of America's system of governance. Adopting a simple, fair, and secure voting system is fundamental to democratic elections. It is clear that plurality elections are much simpler and easier to understand than races determined by ranked choice voting. This analysis of 96 ranked choice voting elections from across the country shows that voting systems produce false majorities, frequently exhaust more than 10% of ballots cast on election day, and further disenfranchise voters who are already less likely to vote. While proponents of ranked choice voting may claim the new voting system is a better alternative to traditional voting systems, the plurality system offers voters an easier method to selecting representatives without false promises from ranked choice voting. So that is a policy pitch for this bill before you, and happy to answer any questions members may have.
Thank you, Mr. Almeida, for that introduction. And due to the constraints of time, I'm not going to be taking questions on the bill because we will bring it back again tomorrow. I would like to note that we do have a committee tomorrow that is unusual, but we are trying to get some work done. So I am going to set an amendment deadline for this bill to be tomorrow, May 11th, by 5 p.m. Just for a mental note, this bill is simply, as was stated, to go back to the system that we had before with the inclusions of the court's provisions that they deemed unconstitutional. I did not make any policy decisions beyond that. I asked legislative legal to just simply provide that draft. So that's what the full 66 sections are. They were not anything beyond me advising, let's get us back to where we were, leaving the dark money provisions in place and those constitutional concerns. Before we conclude our business, Representative Eason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I saw that we've got a House floor session scheduled for tomorrow. I'm just wondering, particularly if the floor session goes as long as it went today, how long do you anticipate the meeting going tomorrow? And I'm just wondering if there's going to be any time between the end of the meeting and the 5 p.m. deadline you set.
That I do not know, Representative Eastman. We do have public testimony scheduled for tomorrow. And as I mentioned before, everything is fluid this time of the session. And my apologies on the timeline on amendment deadlines. As before, you let us know that you have sent that email to legislative legal. They are working very hard, and we will take that into consideration of their timeliness of being able to get that. But we want to make sure that you're thinking through this and getting anything sent to them immediately, because there's only so many days left of session. So that concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Thursday, May 11th at 1 p.m. to continue its work on House Bill 4 elections. And we will be taking up public testimony as well, and for the public listening, if we are delayed, I give my apologies. We're doing the best that we can to be timely on these issues. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It is 5:16 p.m.